A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that hits every parent at some point, usually around 11 p.m. on a Saturday. Your infant spikes a 103 degree fever. You're staring at the medicine cabinet, and suddenly you realize you don't actually know which thermometer to trust, whether that pulse oximeter even works on tiny fingers, and if you're about to accidentally double dose the acetaminophen. The prompt asks, what actually works for home monitoring in the first couple years of life? What's the best thermometer? Are infrared ones reliable enough? What other diagnostic tools are worth having? And are there apps that track fever and medication dosages so you don't cross into dangerous territory?
This matters more now than it did even a few years ago. CDC data showed pediatric urgent care. Wait times jumped 22% between 2023 and 2025. When you're sitting in a waiting room for 3 hours with a febrile 6-month-old, having reliable home data changes the triage conversation entirely.
Or spares you the trip when you realize the numbers don't warrant it.
But here's the thing most parents don't realize. Standard adult medical devices fail on pediatric physiology in ways that aren't obvious. Smaller blood vessels, thinner skin, completely different thermoregulation. A pulse oximeter that works perfectly on your finger can give you dangerously misleading numbers on an infant. A forehead thermometer that reads 98.6 on you might be off by a degree and a half on a baby if you don't know the technique. So we're really talking about three pillars here: oxygenation, temperature, and medication tracking. Each one has pediatric-specific pitfalls that the packaging won't tell you about.
There's this tension that runs through all of it. The gold standard versus what's actually usable at 2 in the morning with a screaming child. Rectal thermometers are the most accurate. They're also, you know, rectal thermometers. Parents hate doing it. Kids hate having it done. So the real question is, when is good enough actually dangerous, and when is it perfectly adequate?
Let's start with pulse oximetry, because this is where the gap between consumer gear and clinical reality is widest. Most parents don't realize that the little finger clip oximeter they bought for $20 on Amazon is essentially useless on a child under 2. The sensor physics are completely different at that scale.
Walk me through why. What's actually failing?
Pulse oximetry works by shining two wavelengths of light, red and infrared, through a pulsating vascular bed, like a fingertip, and measuring how much light gets absorbed. Oxygenated hemoglobin absorbs differently than deoxygenated hemoglobin. The device calculates the ratio and spits out a percentage. That's the basic principle. The problem with infants is threefold. First, their fingers are tiny, so the light path is shorter and the signal is weaker. Second, they move constantly, and motion artifact corrupts the signal. Third, infants have poor peripheral perfusion, meaning less blood flow to the extremities, so the pulsatile signal the device is looking for is already faint. A standard adult oximeter will either fail to get a reading at all, or worse, it'll give you a reading that's wrong.
How wrong are we talking?
The FDA issued a warning in 2024 specifically about over-the-counter pulse oximeters for infants. They cited 11 adverse event reports linked to false reassurance from consumer devices. One specific case, a 6-month-old with RSV, showed 97% on a consumer oximeter, but 89% on a hospital-grade device. That's the difference between looks fine and this child needs oxygen.
89% is get in the car territory.
And the parent was sitting at home thinking everything was fine because a little screen said 97. The technology that actually works for pediatric patients is something called Masimo SET, signal extraction technology. It was originally developed for neonatal eye, CU monitoring in the 1990s, and it remains the only FDA-cleared motion-tolerant pediatric SpO2 technology. The key innovation is that instead of just looking at the raw light absorption ratio, the algorithm separates the arterial signal from the venous signal and from motion artifact using something called adaptive filtering. It essentially identifies which part of the signal is actual pulsatile arterial blood and which part is noise from the baby kicking.
It's doing signal processing that a $20 clip can't touch.
Not even close. A consumer device like the Owlet Smart Sock uses a modified algorithm. It's not the same as clinical Masimo SET, even though Owlet did license some Masimo patents. Independent validation studies show the consumer devices have about a plus or minus 5% error margin on infants versus plus or minus 2% for clinical Masimo. A 5% error on a true saturation of 90% means you could see anything from 85 to 95. That's useless for medical decision-making.
What do you actually buy if you're a parent who wants hospital-grade reliability at home?
The Masimo RAD 67 with a pediatric wrap sensor runs about $400. It uses reflectance technology. The light emitter and detector are on the same side of the sensor, which means you can wrap it around a foot or a hand rather than clipping it on. The other option is the non-N9590 with a pediatric clip, about $300. Both are validated for children under 10 kilograms. The non-N uses transmissive sensors, light passes through the tissue, and for infants, you typically place it on the big toe rather than a finger. Toe placement works better because the digit is larger and the perfusion is more consistent.
The reflectance versus transmissive distinction matters here?
Transmissive sensors need a direct light path through the tissue, which is why they work best on thin body parts like fingers, toes, or earlobes. Reflectance sensors bounce light off the tissue and measure what comes back. They can be placed on the forehead, the foot, anywhere with a flat surface. For a squirming infant, reflectance is more forgiving because the sensor doesn't need perfect alignment. But transmissive sensors, when they get a good signal, tend to be slightly more accurate. The non-N toe clip is transmissive. The Masimo wrap sensor is reflectance. The key is that both are validated for pediatric use, unlike the consumer wearables.
We've established that consumer pulse oximeters can't be trusted on tiny fingers. But what about the other vital sign that keeps parents up at night? Temperature. Let's talk about why your forehead thermometer might be lying to you.
The gold standard for temperature measurement in infants is rectal. The American Academy of Pediatrics mandates rectal temperature for any infant under 3 months with suspected fever. The reason is that at that age, the immune system is immature enough that a fever can be the only sign of a serious bacterial infection, and being off by even half a degree can change the clinical decision. After 3 months, you've got more flexibility, but the accuracy hierarchy matters.
What's the best non-rectal option that actually approaches rectal accuracy?
The Brown Thermoscan 7-ear thermometer is the only non-rectal option that gets within 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit of rectal in children over 3 months. And it does this because of one specific design feature, a pre-warm tip. The probe heats to 34 degrees Celsius before it takes a measurement, which eliminates what's called the ear canal cooling artifact. Here's what happens with the standard ear thermometer. You insert a cool probe into the ear canal. The probe itself cools the ear canal slightly, and the infrared sensor reads a falsely low temperature. The Brown pre-warms the tip, so the ear canal doesn't cool on contact, and the reading is dramatically more accurate as a result. Studies show the difference is about 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit of additional error in non-pre-warmed ear thermometers.
That's a genuinely clever piece of engineering for a consumer device.
It really is. Now, infrared temporal artery thermometers, the ones you sweep across the forehead, are the most convenient option, but they're also the most technique-dependent. The Exergen TAT5000 is the reference standard here, and the correct technique is not what most people do. You don't just press it to the forehead and click. You place it in the center of the forehead, press and hold the button, then sweep laterally across the forehead to the hairline, then lift and touch behind the earlobe, then slide down the mastoid process behind the ear. That full sweep crosses the temporal artery at multiple points and averages the reading. Done correctly, studies show an average deviation of 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit from rectal. Done incorrectly, just pressing it to the forehead and releasing, the deviation jumps to 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit.
The forehead thermometer isn't inaccurate by design. It's inaccurate by user error.
Most of the time, yes. The other common mistake is measuring on a sweaty forehead. Evaporative cooling drops the skin temperature significantly, and the thermometer reads artifactually low. Same thing if the baby's been sucking on a pacifier. The temporal artery branches into the facial region, and the altered blood flow from sucking can mess with the reading. You want a dry forehead and no pacifier for at least 2 minutes before you measure.
For the under 3 months crowd, none of this matters because you're doing rectal anyway.
The AAP is unambiguous on this. Under 3 months, rectal is mandatory. The Vicks Baby Rectal Thermometer is the standard drugstore option. It has a short, flexible tip with a stopper to prevent overinsertion. You insert about half an inch, no more. Lubricate with petroleum jelly, and never use the same thermometer orally later. This is not a crossover device.
The rectal thermometer is the guest towel of the medicine cabinet. You don't mix it up with the others.
Actually, a perfect analogy. I'm going to remember that.
Now that we've covered the two big vital signs, oxygen and temperature, let's talk about the third piece of the puzzle that most parents overlook. What else can you actually measure at home that gives a pediatrician useful information?
There are three tools I put in the worth having and learning to use. Category. The first is a pediatric stethoscope, specifically the 3M Littmann Classic 3 with the 27-inch pediatric bell. And before anyone panics, I'm not saying parents should diagnose heart murmurs. The practical use here is lung sounds. Being able to tell the difference between wheezing, stridor, and crackles gives you enormously useful information for the triage phone call.
Break those three sounds down.
Wheezing is a high-pitched musical sound, usually on exhalation. It means the lower airways are narrowed, classic for asthma or bronchiolitis. Stridor is a harsh, crowing sound on inhalation. That's upper airway obstruction, and it's always worth an immediate call to the pediatrician because it can indicate croup or a foreign body. Crackles are fine, popping sounds like rubbing hair between your fingers near your ear. Those suggest fluid in the alveoli, which could be pneumonia. The key technique tip for infants, listen on the back, between the shoulder blades. Lung sounds are clearest there in small children because the chest wall is thinner posteriorly. The anterior chest on an infant gives you more heart sounds and bowel sounds than lung sounds.
You're not trying to diagnose. You're trying to describe accurately. Instead of "my baby sounds weird when breathing," you can say, "I'm hearing a high-pitched musical sound on exhalation between the shoulder blades."
That's a completely different level of information for the pediatrician on call. The second underused tool is a glucose meter, something like the ACOCHECK guide. Parents of febrile infants should know about hypoglycemia risk. Febrile seizures can be triggered by low blood sugar, not just high fever. If your child has been vomiting, hasn't eaten in 12 hours, and then spikes a fever, the seizure risk is compounded by hypoglycemia. A fingerstick glucose reading under 60 milligrams per deciliter in an infant is worth an ER visit regardless of what the temperature is doing.
I had no idea febrile seizures had a blood sugar component.
Most parents don't. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but the data is clear. Hypoglycemia lowers the seizure threshold, and fever independently lowers it further. Combined, you get a much higher risk. The third tool is maybe the least glamorous, but arguably the most useful, a pediatric urine collection bag. The Hollister U-Bag is the standard one. UTIs are the number one bacterial infection in febrile infants under 3 months, and the symptoms are nonspecific, just fever, irritability, maybe poor feeding. You can't diagnose a UTI without a urine sample, and collecting a clean catch from an infant is basically impossible without a collection bag.
How does the bag work?
It's a sterile plastic bag with an adhesive opening that sticks around the perineum. You clean the area thoroughly first, apply the bag, and wait for the baby to void. Once you've got a sample, you can use a home dipstick, the same urine test strips used for adults, to check for leukocytes and nitrites. Positive for both is highly suggestive of a UTI. The important caveat: the bag has to be removed within 30 minutes of application, and if the baby has soiled the area, you need to start over with a new bag. Contamination from skin flora is the main limitation. But even a contaminated sample that shows negative leukocytes and nitrites is useful information. It makes UTI less likely.
You've got the temperature logged, the oxygen reading, and maybe even a urine sample. But the most dangerous part of home monitoring isn't the measurement. It's the medication that follows. Let's talk about the apps that can keep your child safe from dosing errors.
This is where things get scary if you're not tracking carefully. The two main fever medications, acetaminophen and ibuprofen, have completely different dosing schedules and maximum daily limits. Acetaminophen is dosed at 15 milligrams per kilogram every 4 hours, with a maximum of 5 doses in 24 hours. Ibuprofen is 10 milligrams per kilogram every 6 hours, maximum of 4 doses in 24 hours. Parents often alternate them. Acetaminophen, then 3 hours later, ibuprofen, then 3 hours later, acetaminophen again, which can work well for fever control, but it creates a tracking nightmare. Each drug has its own cumulative ceiling, and if you're not logging every dose with a timestamp, it's extremely easy to accidentally give a fifth dose of acetaminophen at hour 20.
The doses are weight-based, so you can't just read the bottle and call it a day.
And here's the compounding danger. The concentration differs between products. Infant acetaminophen drops are 160 milligrams per 5 milliliters. Children's acetaminophen suspension is also 160 milligrams per 5 milliliters. They standardized that in 2011 to reduce errors. But some parents still have old bottles of the concentrated infant drops that were 80 milligrams per 0.8 milliliters. If you dose based on the old concentration using the new product's volume, you're underdosing by half. Or worse, the reverse.
What apps actually handle this properly?
There are three worth naming. Mango Health is FDI registered as a medication adherence tool, and it has a pediatric dosing calculator that uses weight-based dosing. You input your child's weight in kilograms, and it calculates the correct dose for both acetaminophen and ibuprofen. More importantly, it tracks cumulative 24-hour intake and warns you when you're approaching the max for either drug. If you logged acetaminophen at 8 a.m., noon, and 4 p.m., and you try to log another dose at 7 p.m., it'll flag that you're about to exceed the daily limit.
Does it handle the alternating schedule?
Care Clinic is actually better for alternating regimens specifically. It lets you create custom medication schedules with push notifications, so you can set it to remind you ibuprofen due at the 6-hour mark and acetaminophen due at the 4-hour mark, running in parallel. The interface is slightly more complex than Mango Health, but the scheduling flexibility is better for parents who are intentionally alternating. The third app is Baby Tracker by Nipe, which is less about medication safety per se, and more about integrated logging. It tracks temperature, medication, symptoms, feeding, and diapers all in a single timeline view. The killer feature is that it exports the whole log as a PDF you can hand to your pediatrician. Instead of walking into the appointment and saying she had a fever Tuesday night, I think it was around 102, you've got a timestamp chart showing every reading.
That export feature is useful. I've been the parent scribbling temperatures on a post-it note at 3 a.m., and then the pediatrician asks when the fever spiked, and I'm squinting at my own handwriting trying to decipher whether that says 102 or 103.
The post-it note is the Universal Pediatric Fever Log. And it works until it doesn't. The other app worth mentioning is Pediatric Dose Calculator by Dr. Smith. It's free, no ads, and it uses the AAP Red Book dosing guidelines. What makes it different is that it flags off-label combinations. If you've logged ibuprofen and then try to log a cough syrup that contains acetaminophen, which many multi-symptom cold medicines do, it'll warn you that you're double-dipping on the same drug class.
That's a huge problem that most parents don't think about. The fever reducer and the cold medicine are separate bottles, separate aisles in the pharmacy, but they both contain acetaminophen.
It's one of the most common causes of pediatric acetaminophen overdose. A parent gives the correct dose of acetaminophen for fever, then an hour later gives a dose of a multi-symptom cold relief liquid that also contains acetaminophen, and suddenly the child has received double the intended dose. The liver doesn't care which bottle it came from. The app catching that is life-saving technology.
Let's walk through a concrete scenario. It's 2 a.m. Your 8-month-old has 103-degree fever. You gave acetaminophen at 10 p.m. You're exhausted. You're holding the baby in one arm and your phone in the other hand. Which of these apps is fastest for logging a temperature and checking whether you can give the next dose?
Baby Tracker wins on one-handed speed. The interface is designed for sleep-deprived parents. The temperature entry is a big plus button. You tap the reading, it timestamps automatically, and the medication log is right below it. Two taps to log a temperature, two more to log a dose. Mango Health is slightly more deliberate. You're scrolling through a medication list and confirming doses, which is safer but slower. Care Clinic is the most powerful but also the most cumbersome at 2 a.m. My recommendation would be Baby Tracker for daily use and Mango Health as the safety backstop for dosing limits.
What about sharing this data with your actual pediatrician? Because none of this matters if the doctor can't see it.
This is the data sharing problem, and it's the weakest link in the whole chain. Most of these apps don't integrate with Epic or Cerner, which are the two major electronic health record systems used by hospitals and pediatric practices. The 2025 HL7 FHR standard update added pediatric growth chart integration, so your pediatrician can now pull in height and weight data from connected devices, but medication logging remains completely siloed. There's no standard API for here's what I gave my kid at 3 a.m.
You've got this beautiful timestamp log and your pediatrician can't import it.
The workaround is clunky but functional. Apple Health's Health Records feature lets you manually export a CSV of temperature logs if you've been entering them there. You can email that CSV to your pediatrician's portal before the appointment. Baby Tracker's PDF export is the better option for most parents. You generate the report, save it, and upload it through the patient portal messaging system. It's not real-time integration, but it gets the information into the doctor's hands before they walk into the exam room, which is what actually matters.
Let me ask about something the prompt hinted at. Dosage calculation errors. What's the most common mistake you've seen?
The number one error is calculating the dose in milliliters based on the wrong concentration. A parent knows the child needs 120 milligrams of acetaminophen. They grab the bottle and see 160 milligrams per 5 milliliters. They do the math wrong and give 7 milliliters instead of 3.75. The child gets nearly double the intended dose. The double-check protocol I recommend is calculate the dose in milligrams per kilogram first, verify that number, then convert to milliliters using the specific concentration on the bottle you're holding right now. Don't assume all bottles are the same. And never use a kitchen spoon. The variability in kitchen teaspoons is enormous, from 2.5 to 7 milliliters. Use the dosing syringe that comes with the medication.
We've talked about tools, techniques, and apps. Let's step back and talk about when to stop monitoring. There's a point where constant checking becomes counterproductive.
The when to stop monitoring rule is something pediatricians don't state explicitly enough. If your child is alert, drinking fluids, and has produced a wet diaper in the last 6 hours, you can reduce monitoring frequency to every 4 hours. Constant checking, every 30 minutes through the night, increases parental anxiety without clinical benefit. You're not going to catch a clinically significant desaturation in a child who's pink, active, and drinking. The monitoring itself becomes a source of stress that disrupts the very thing the child needs most, which is sleep.
The red line thresholds? The numbers where you stop monitoring and start driving.
Four numbers to memorize. CO2 below 92%, not 95. Pediatricians use 92 as the cutoff for concern because infant oxygen saturation normally runs slightly lower than adults, especially during sleep. Temperature above 100.4 rectally in an infant under 3 months. That's an immediate ER visit. No call to the pediatrician first, just go. Temperature above 104 at any age, call the pediatrician, even if the child looks fine. And no wet diaper in 8 hours, that's the dehydration threshold. More than 8 hours without urine output in an infant means they need IV fluids.
92% is lower than I would have guessed. Most parents see anything below 95 and panic.
That's one of the misconceptions we should address directly. A consumer pulse oximeter reading of 95% or above does not mean your baby is fine. Consumer oximeters can read 5% high on infants due to motion artifact and poor perfusion. A 95% reading could actually be 90%. The device has given you a number, but the number is lying. This is why I keep hammering on validated pediatric devices. The error margin on a Masimo or Nonin is tight enough that you can trust the 92% threshold. On a consumer device, you can't.
Another misconception. Temporal artery thermometers are as accurate as rectal.
Only when performed with the correct technique, the full sweep from forehead to mastoid, and even then, average deviation is 0.4 degrees. That's acceptable for monitoring trends in a 6-month-old with a known viral illness, but it's not acceptable for clinical decision-making in an infant under 3 months. For the under 3 months crowd, the 0.4 degree deviation could be the difference between low-grade fever, observe at home, and this infant needs a septic workup. The stakes are too high for good enough.
The alternating medication myth, that you can safely alternate acetaminophen and ibuprofen every 2 hours.
This one is dangerous. The logic sounds reasonable, they're different drugs, so alternating gives continuous fever coverage without exceeding the dose of either one. The problem is that each drug has its own maximum daily dose, and the alternating schedule makes it extremely easy to lose track. The AAP recommends a minimum 4-hour interval for acetaminophen and 6-hour interval for ibuprofen. If you're alternating every 2 hours, you're almost certainly exceeding one of those minimums. And the cumulative acetaminophen dose over 24 hours is the one that damages the liver, even if no single dose was too high.
What about the idea that a higher fever means a more serious infection?
Fever height does not correlate with illness severity in children. 104-degree fever from roseola is uncomfortable but benign. 100.5-degree fever with lethargy from meningitis is a medical emergency. The number on the thermometer tells you the body's thermostat set point has been raised. It doesn't tell you why. Parents get fixated on bringing the number down, but the number itself isn't the danger. It's what the number represents in combination with how the child looks and behaves. A child with 103 who's running around the living room is less concerning than a child with 101 who's limp and won't make eye contact.
That's probably the single most important thing for parents to internalize. The thermometer is one data point. The child in front of you is the whole clinical picture.
That's really the thesis of everything we've been saying. The tools matter. A validated pulse oximeter, a proper thermometer, a medication tracking app, but they're inputs to a decision you make by looking at your child. The technology reduces uncertainty. It doesn't eliminate the need for judgment.
Let's pull this into a coherent system. If you're a parent setting up a home monitoring kit, what's the triad?
The home monitoring triad is three things. 1. A validated pediatric pulse oximeter. Masimo RAD 67 or non in 9590, not a consumer wearable. 2. For infants under 3 months, a rectal thermometer with a flexible tip and a stopper. For infants over 3 months, the Braun ThermoScan 7-ear thermometer or the Exogen temporal artery thermometer if you're willing to learn the proper sweep technique and accept the slightly wider error margin. 3. A medication logging app with weight-based dosing and cumulative max alerts. Mango Health for safety, Baby Tracker for integrated logging, and PDF Export, Care Clinic, if you're running an alternating schedule and want push notifications.
The actionable step before your next pediatrician visit.
Download one of these apps tonight. I'd recommend Mangle Health or Baby Tracker, and input your child's current weight. Then practice logging a mock fever scenario. Enter a temperature, log a dose of acetaminophen, set a reminder for 4 hours later, log the next dose, and watch what the app does when you approach the 24-hour limit. Do this when you're calm and well-rested, because you won't learn the interface at 3 a.m. with a screaming child. The time to figure out that the plus button is in the wrong corner is not during a crisis.
Let's zoom out for a moment. The 2026 pediatric home monitoring device market is projected to hit $4.2 billion. The FDA approved the first AI-based infant respiratory rate monitor last year. We're heading toward a world where parents have more diagnostic data than ever before. Is that actually good?
That's the open question. More data can mean more clarity, or it can mean more anxiety. The skill of data triage, knowing which numbers matter and which ones are noise, is going to become as important as the devices themselves. A parent who gets a pulse oximeter and checks their child's oxygen saturation every 15 minutes through a mild cold is going to drive themselves insane and probably call the pediatrician unnecessarily. A parent who understands that SpO2 only matters if the child looks sick, that fever height doesn't equal illness severity, and that the trend over hours matters more than any single reading. That parent is empowered, not anxious.
The tools are amplifiers. They amplify good judgment as much as they amplify anxiety.
And the judgment part can't be outsourced to an app. The app can tell you that you're approaching the maximum daily dose of acetaminophen. It can't tell you whether your child's lethargy is post-fever fatigue or the early sign of sepsis. That distinction still requires a parent who's paying attention, who knows their child's baseline, and who knows when to stop monitoring and start driving.
On that note, we should probably let Hilbert do his thing before we wrap.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, French microbiologist Émile Marchal claimed to have discovered a new cheese-ripening bacterium in a sample sent from Chad, naming it Brevibacterium chadense. 40 years later, it was corrected. The sample had been contaminated in transit by a lab technician's unwashed hands, and the discovery was actually a common strain of Brevibacterium linens, the same microbe responsible for the orange rind on Limburger.
A 40-year retraction? That's rough.
At least the technician's hands were historically productive.
This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you've got a home monitoring horror story, or a success, especially the 2 a.m. kind, where you're not sure if you did the right thing, send it to us at My Weird Prompts. We might compile listener experiences for a follow-up. And if you found this useful, leave us a review wherever you listen. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Trust the data, but trust your eyes more.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.